Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show, I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bets.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Carson's Corner is brought to you by www.graythought.com. That's www.graythought.com. And onthemat.com. Please make sure to visit www.onthemat.com. Hello, folks. Welcome to Carson's Corner. Are you guys getting ready for the 4th of July holiday this Monday? I'm so excited. I'll be working, but after work, I'm probably going to head on down to a local fireworks display and have some good time. I hope you and your family are going to enjoy this holiday weekend, and I wish you the very, very best in whatever you're doing this weekend. On this episode, we have Jeff Munson. The Snowman is a perennial title contender in every major MMA promotion and a controversial yet intriguing figure outside of the ring. I spoke to Jeff Munson last night for about an hour and a half. Now, you guys know that we're both, I want to say, activists. He's definitely more of an activist than I am, okay? I'll be the first to admit that. We're both very passionate, and we both agree on many of the same things. So, a lot of this interview was about politics. I know this is an MMA show, I understand that, but you have to understand that Jeff and I are extremely passionate about some political issues here. So, you know, I think you're really, really going to enjoy this interview. We spoke about the Brian Stann controversy. Hear what Jeff has to say about that. We spoke about his fight against Daniel Cormier, but there was a lot of talk about politics and different issues that have occurred over the vast amount of time here in America. And I just want to let you guys know that right now. I mean, if you're a person out there that doesn't like politics just understand that both Jeff and I are very, very passionate, okay? Before we go to that, I just want to inform you, actually probably some of you already know this out there, that Brett Rogers was arrested. Pretty, pretty serious situation. MMA Junkie and other outlets are reporting that Brett Rogers was arrested for third-degree assault and misdemeanor, child endangerment, after allegedly hitting and choking his wife. Many of you know that I talked to Brett earlier in the year in a picture of him and I together at the Strikeforce show in New Jersey actually made it to a couple different sites. Brett has always been a really nice and personable guy around me, so I would say that I was a bit shocked to hear about his arrest on domestic violence charges. Even seemingly mild-mannered people can explode in rages. Believe me, I have my moments too, okay? But I was disappointed to hear that Rogers had apparently also been physical towards his children. That's unacceptable in a civilized society, and if he is responsible for this, if he is in fact guilty, then he's going to pay a price for this, and he really should, okay? And, you know, any man should not hit a child, should not hit a woman. Violence is just unacceptable. So we'll see what happens. I just hope that the allegations against him aren't true, but only time will tell. Okay, you know, there was allegations against Tito Ortiz, and as much as I didn't like Tito Ortiz, everything seemed to turn out his way with regards to that. I don't know. As far as him fighting, it's hard to imagine Brett Rogers making a living without fighting. I mean, I'm sure he's capable, but I mean, in this job market, you know, he could potentially be a title contender at heavyweight. All he would have to do is just focus a little bit more on the ground. I wish him all the best. I do. His kids, I wish the best. I wish his wife the best, and I hope they get their situation worked out. All right, now that that's out of the way, let's go to our interview with Jeff Monson. This is, like I said, an hour and a half interview. We're going to break it up in two spots here today on Carson's Corner. We're going to start off talking about the Brian Stann controversy. Brian Stann recently made comments suggesting that Monson should stop complaining about the U.S. or move to Mexico. It's that old love-it-or-leave-it strategy. Good thing our founding fathers didn't set up a majority female island colony somewhere with coconuts, right? Good thing there was abolitionists amongst our founding fathers. Good thing that we didn't have this mindset during the civil rights struggle in America. I can go on and on and on and on, and Jeff and I will go on and on and on about our opinions with regards to Brian Stann, the military, the economic structure in America. And let me tell you something. Jeff Monson is... I'm going to go back and listen to this interview again, because Jeff Monson has a lot of information. Both of us have a lot of information, okay? And I don't pat myself on the back when I say that, but I read a lot of books, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I consider myself relatively informed when it comes to the history of our economy and the current state of political affairs right now. And I think you'll really, really enjoy this. You'll learn a lot. You know, I learned a lot from Jeff in this interview, and I'm sure that he learned some things from me. You know, there was numerous times throughout this interview where he's like, that's a great point, that's a great point. And he was making a lot of great points too. So here it is. Here is part one of our interview with Jeff Monson. When we come back, we're going to give you some news and rumors here. And I don't think we have any listener emails. We've got some Kimbo news. Kimbo's about to make his boxing debut. We've got James Toney and Ken Shamrock. I saw this press conference. It was, you know, it is what it is. We'll talk about that and a little bit more here on Carson's Corner. So here it is. Here is part one of our interview with Mr. Jeff Monson. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Monson needs very little introduction to fans of mixed martial arts, whether it's for his fighting, political views, or criminal protest actions. Monson has grabbed headlines and chokes all over the world. Jeff, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Had a good day. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, no problem. We wanted to get you on the show for a while. I met you in December of 2009 at the U.S. Grappling FILA Championships in Fort Lauderdale. And you're a perfect fit for us in many ways. You might be sick of being described as one of the most interesting characters in mixed martial arts, but you definitely have opinions that many people in the sport have never really engaged with or considered themselves. You recently were the subject of some comments by Brian Stann, who said he hoped that Daniel Cormier beat you, quote, into Mexico for your perceived disrespect of the United States. What's your response to Captain Stann?
I saw that, and I actually tweeted back, you know, just, you know, it's one of those things where you know there's either right or wrong. And I think we're in a position where most people can't make that assertion because they don't have the right information. You know, they're looking at the local paper or just, you know, seeing what, you know, the, you know, Fox News or CNN says and stuff like that. That's so biased information. You know, that's not really what's going on in the world. You know, we have people, children dying every day. We're in you know, because they don't have enough to eat. You know, I just read, you know, I have a one-year-old that I was reading that article. You know, and they estimate that 3 million babies die every month within the first month of their lives because they don't have, like, just general cleanliness and clean water and just, like, basics. 3 million kids a year die within the first month of their life because they just don't have, you know, sanitation. I mean, that's crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just think that people just don't have, you know, the knowledge. You know, we're in countries where, you know, people, I think Brian Stan was in the military, if I'm not mistaken, and, you know, this, but, you know, for me, that's really the hypocrisy of the whole thing, is that those soldiers, they're dying for, you know, politics, for oil. You know, I mean, there was no weapons of mass destruction.
Sure.
You know, they knew it. The UN was in there for 2 years, actually 3 years. They were in there since the first Gulf War.
Right.
Every month. We knew exactly what they had and what they didn't have. We knew it was going to be a cakewalk, you know, walking right in there. And it was just for oil. We knew that. But
it was also, you know, also for political reasons, because George W. Bush in 1999 told Mickey Herskowitz, who was an attorney and a writer and a family friend of the Bush family, he told Mickey Herskowitz that he was disappointed that his father didn't do a full-scale invasion of Iraq in the 1990s. His father, in George W. Bush's mind, had a lot of political capital, and he wasted it by not invading Iraq to the full scale. And he said that if he had an opportunity, he would invade Iraq. He would not pass it up. And he did. And ultimately in 2004, he got reelected questionably. Some say that, there was some, you know, suspicious activity in Ohio. But your point is well taken. It was based on a lie. Charles Dufler, the UN weapons inspector, said in 1998 that they had no weapons of mass destruction, that we had destroyed, the UN had destroyed their weapons of mass destruction. And the reason why they had weapons in the first place is because we gave it to them.
We gave them to them. Yeah, we gave them to them to fight Iran, and we gave weapons, we sold weapons to Iran to fight Iraq. I mean.
Exactly.
I mean, when you point this out to people, it's almost like it goes, like, they don't believe it. Like, no, or they don't want to acknowledge it, or they put it back in their mind, or whatever. It's always like, when you put the facts out, it's, like, it doesn't matter. They're so set on what they want to do, and they just fall, like, I just think we're so brainwashed as a society that we just can't accept new information, and like, to think the United States would be up to something that criminal and
sure.
evil. Is like, we can't comprehend it. I mean, we created that virus that, you know, attacked Iran's nuclear, you know, computers with the help of Israel. And, you know, it's like, we're messing with them. We don't want that. They come out openly and say, we are not making weapons. We are doing this for power, only power. They're not threatening, you know, in any way. But we say, we're using this for power. How are we as a country to decide when they haven't then attacked us, they haven't attacked you know, anyone other than Iraq, which we were giving them weapons for, how can we decide what they do? We have, you know, Israel has over 400 nuclear warheads from the United States. You know, Pakistan, you know, we're selling them weapons. We're selling India weapons. We're selling all over the world. We have 107 bases, army bases across, or military bases across the world in different areas. Different 107 different countries, and we're deciding that this country can't use nuclear energy for power because we don't like them. And it's like, my God, like how can we do that? We're the only country in the world that's used that kind of destruction in, you know, on hand.
We've overthrown. We've overthrown more democratically elected governments than any other country. We have military bases all around the world, as you alluded to. And now we're having this debate about spending, but yet we're subsidizing many of these countries. I mean, we're spending almost $1 trillion each year on military spending. And this is money that's just being wasted. I mean, literally, you know, $6 billion a few weeks ago.
Wait, turned on military. Missing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a cut. I read this interesting article. We spend more money on weapons or on military than every other country in the world combined. And that, I mean, some of that is the money that we give these countries, but we spend more on, just imagine, think of that statement. We spend more, one country spends more on military than the rest of the world combined.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and it's doubled since 1997.
We're talking about not having money for, you know, our citizens, and all the health care is too expensive, and, you know, we need to cut back social programs. And, you know, Detroit, I just read, closed four high schools in Detroit because they didn't have the money for it. So those four high schools, those students got to, you know, integrate into, you know, local other high schools. I mean, and they're going to be swamped, you know. They're already overcrowded. Think of that. What kind of education are they going to get? You know, we take away parks, and we take away education and health care. Everything that's for the people, we take away. We don't have the money. But we always have the money for military. We always have the money for corporate welfare. We always have money for these massive, you know, campaigns and reelection and money for this and that, but not for the people. It's just priority.
Amen. You're absolutely right. One thing that really bothered me about Stan's comments was his comment about Mexico. He obviously considers Mexico to be inferior, to be an inferior country. And this, you know, plays right into the mindset of, it's almost fascism in a sense where, you know, America is right, and if you criticize America, then you're unpatriotic, you should move out of it. And this is the type of mindset that has led us into war in the past. This is the type of mindset that is very, very dangerous, and a lot of it stems from ignorance. So that was another thing. It almost seemed like a racist comment on his part when it comes to Mexico.
It's a very, very much like a fascist, you know, statement that he said. And, but like I said, it is the mindset, but it's what you hear. You know, it's like anything against the United States, like you said, is unpatriotic. Unpatriotic now is like back in, you know, the Middle Ages, you know, cursing God. Like, you know, God is, I mean, you're going to get, you know, the Inquisition's after you. It's like, you can't say anything against the United States or point out things, even truth, because the mindset of like, patriotic and, you know, this strong sense of nationalism. One of my old professors used to say, like, any kind of isms and too much is a bad thing. Any kind of isms. And, you know, I think patriotism now, I mean, it's really bad. It's, you know, it makes you not think. When you, like, believe what they say, it makes you not think for yourself. And that's what they want, though, you know. I mean, they're off doing what they do. You know, the military is doing this. We don't know where our money's going. We don't, you know, and for the most part, we don't want to know. And we just want to, you know, keep our jobs and, you know, kind of continue being a wage slave as long as we can pay our bills. And, you know, it's not us that's losing our house or losing our car, getting foreclosed or whatever, keeping our job. And, you know, we're just going to go along with the system. And, you know, it's sad. And, you know, Brian Sand, it's, you know, that he was in the military, and that's, you know, they really do. They brainwash you, you know, going in. And, you know, I talked to a lot of the guys used to work at my gym, work out at the gym. Sorry. They were in the military. I lost a couple of them, in Iraq. And most of them say that, like, I wish I had known what I know now going in. It's just, most of them don't want to be there anymore. And
right. It's what Thomas Jefferson feared, is that an army would be the military, having a military in peacetime, although there's really never any peacetime, would be an escape from poverty. And I think that's why a lot of people now, the military recruiters have no problem meeting their recruiting goals, because there's just, poverty is rampant here. I mean, income inequality is just greater in this country than Ethiopia, than any other industrialized country. Not that Ethiopia, but, you know, you get the point.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
people are joining the military.
If you look at it, they target inner city kids. They target, you know, the poor rural kids that, you know, like, that aren't going to college and, you know, they have whatever. I mean, the ROTC guys are the rarity, you know. It's the guys that all, what are they going to do? You know, the economy's bad. There's not a lot of jobs out there. It's like, you're going to make, working at your local gas station in the same town that you grew up in for, you know, $7 an hour, or are you going to join the military? They make all these promises and you go around, you know, the world and you can be a hero and this, you know. And I fly a lot and, you know, just on the, you know, traveling there, and it's just the whole mindset. And, you know, you have these souls, like if there's a soldier on the plane, like, oh, we'd like to take our time to thank our soldiers for protecting our country. In one regard, it's like,
right,
like, you know, okay, you guys have sacrificed a lot. Okay, my hat's off to you, but it's glorified. It's a way that the media, the government, they keep it going. It's like, you can't say anything against the military because these guys are out, like risking their lives for you. How can you possibly be against them? They're risking their lives for democracy, for America, for you, for your family.
Yeah.
You can say what you want to say, and you're sitting there bashing them. How could you possibly do that? When in fact, they're fighting for nothing other than profit
for corporations,
for, like you mentioned before, for politics, for, you know, for something that has nothing to, for the exact opposite of democracy.
Harry Truman warned us about the military, or no, Dwight Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. And I think, look, you're right. We have to take our hats off to them, because if there were a country that declared war on us, or if there were a natural disaster here, these people would help, and these people would stand presumably between us and our enemies. But I would argue, Jeff, that the United States military is a different entity than it was, you know, during World War II. We've switched from defending ourselves to nation building now. And nation building is a euphemism for expansion of capitalism. See, capitalism can only be so profitable here in the United States. That's why we have to, quote, nation build in places like North Korea and Vietnam to quote, stop communism. But really, all we're doing is making those countries accessible to American businesses. You know, look at Iraq. I look at Iraq as a business venture. I mean, when you create a business, you level the infrastructure, you rebuild it, and you put your people in charge there, and you have your businesses flourish within, you know, this new community. And that's what we're doing in Iraq. The people don't like it. We've created a major problem there. In Afghanistan, there was a $2 billion GDP prior to our invasion of Afghanistan. Now we have the corrupt Karzai government in charge and the Taliban. It's like, you know, you can't nation build on a population that does not want to subscribe to your economic policies. It's just the bottom line.
In Central America, Nicaragua,
sure,
all those countries there, that's the same thing. You know, the Iran-Contra affair and all that. That's what it's going on there. The IMF, I mean, for an example right now, like what's going on in Greece and stuff. You know, they go in, they go, hey, we'll loan you this money, but we're going to control your infrastructure. We're going to control your railroads, your water, your electricity and all this. And you're going to cut all these programs. You're going to cut education. You're going to cut, you know, like parks. You're going to cut, you know,
Medicare,
anything that has to do with Medicare, social programs, all this. And you're just going to pay us back with interest. And so who suffers? They go, oh, yeah, okay, we're paying back this loan. And we got them out of it. They're saving the banks. They're going there to save the goddamn banks.
Yep.
And the people suffer. And the banks are making money. You know, they're the ones that are. They're making money, and we're going to save them, and the people, like, you know, there's austerity, like going to austerity and everything. So, we got to do this for our nation. We're not doing it for the nation.
No.
That's the lie. It's just like the military. We're not doing it for the nation. They're doing it for goddamn corporations, for banks, for multinationals, for these politicians that make these deals. You know, they're the ones that are profiting, and we're the ones holding the bag. We're the ones, you know, toiling in the fields and the manufacturing plants and doing all the work, and it doesn't do us any good. We're the ones that have to suffer, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
For years and years to pay back these loans, years and years and years and years, and what does it do? It saves the banks.
That's right. And the banks are, we have an economy that's built on finance. You know, prior to Ronald Reagan, we had twice the manufacturing jobs in America. We had a high rate of unionization. We had a high tax rate on millionaires and billionaires, which kept the economy from becoming a casino economy. Reagan came in and blew everything to high hell. And you know what, Jeff, to illustrate your point about our government's priorities, think back to in 2010, just last year in December, when you had millions of people, millions of Americans, their unemployment benefits were running out, right? And, the Republicans did not want to extend their unemployment benefits unless we extend.
They veto them getting, how can you do that? So in America, you veto, like, this person's out, had a job, got, the economy went up in smoke. You know, they're looking for a job, whatever, like that, and you veto, you cancel their unemployment benefits?
And not only that, they want to eliminate the estate tax so the Walton family can get $40 billion. They want to eliminate the estate tax. Walton family gets $40 billion. Well, it would give away $500 billion over 10 years to the nation's wealthiest Americans, and we can't even extend people's unemployment benefits. In other countries, unemployment is continuous. You stay on unemployment until you have a job, and guess what? A lot of these other countries are not suffering like us. It is just amazing. I mean, you know, there's so many different issues here. I mean, but the point is the same, that millionaires and billionaires control the means of production. And you know what, Jeff? If a guy like you were on TV, you know, right now there's just very few liberals on television and very few liberals on radio. I'm convinced if more people like you were on TV and on radio prior to our invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, we probably wouldn't have been in those countries.
You're right. It's about, you made a good point. It's about public opinion. It's the reason that we got out of Vietnam, because the reporters were allowed there. I mean, all America got to see what was really going on. They got to see the casualties, the inhumane treatment of, you know, the villagers that were killed, and our soldiers coming back in body bags, and the whole atrocity of the whole thing. And they're like, it became political suicide to support that war. So that's why we pulled out. And this war, you're not even allowed to see that stuff. You know, we're not allowed to see, but they show us little clips of like a smart bomb going through a door and blowing up a specific target, but we don't see the real thing there. Like everything, you know, soldiers are being, for leaking that stuff, they're being court-martialed, you know, for leaking like real stuff, them like killing people and some of the stuff and some of the pictures coming back. You know, if they find out that, you know, anything's leaking that they haven't approved on, maybe the soldiers are getting court-martialed for it. So we don't see the atrocity. The UN has estimated that 800,000 people have lost their lives in Iraq since our invasion, since 2004.
Wow.
That's Americans, that's civilians, that's, you know, everybody. 800, that's, imagine, close to a million people have lost their lives.
Yeah.
You know, we set up our, you know, made sure that, you know, Brechtel and Brown and all those had their, you know, their things set up there. We made sure that the first thing we did is make sure the oil was going again. We fixed all the oil that Saddam had blown up. You know, everything going. They didn't have electricity and water so fairly recently, so like 2 years ago. You know, in Baghdad.
Almost all the world's refugees are refugees because of our military action, and that is an absolute fact. I mean, we're talking about 5 million people that have been displaced in Iraq. A significant amount of Afghani people, the Afghanistan people are now refugees. I mean, this is just going on and on and on, and we wonder why the world has such a negative opinion on us. Let's talk about hypothetical matches between you and Stan. How do you think an MMA fight would pan out between you two?
Well, I would meet him at 205. I'm going to 205 anyway. I'd love to go on 205 and meet him. And the match lasts one round, and it would be a submission. So I take him down and submit him. And, I don't have anything, you know, he says those comments that are, you know, it doesn't, they don't even make me angry or frustrate me or anything like that. The frustration is just the general ignorance. And it's doubly sad that, he was one of the guys, you know, sacrificed. I mean, it is a sacrifice. And, you know, I always tell people, like, that you know, accusing me of, like, how can you not support our troops? How can you not, you know, and I'm like, I support our troops. I support them a lot. You know how I support them? I don't go to a store and buy a $5.99, you know, yellow ribbon and magnet and put it on the back of my car and then applaud every time, you know, they go, hey, thanks to our troops. I'm actively trying to get our government to stop these ridiculous wars that are openly, like, obviously only for profit, and yep. get our soldiers out of there. Get them back to their families. What would be more appreciative? Clapping when they're on the plane or running around with the magnet on your car, or having them, getting them home to their families, to their friends, to their, you know, careers here, or, you know, and you brought up a great point, like, what if there's something here? What if there's something in the United States that we need them for? Well, look back at Katrina. What happened to Katrina? There was not only did Bush divert money that was supposed to go for the dikes and stuff away prior to Katrina, which caused it, but there was no, we didn't have our National Guard there. Our National Guard was off in Iraq. So we were about 30% the level that we normally were in the New Orleans area, and when the tragedy happened, imagine if we had all those National Guardsmen there, you know, building the dike, you know, the whole thing happened because of the flooding. You know, it wasn't because of, you know, the actual, you know, hurricane coming through and ripping through New Orleans. It was the flooding that it caused. And we weren't, not only was the money diverted from the dike, but the people, the soldiers weren't there. The National Guard, who was there to guard the United States to help the national disasters, 70% of them were gone in Iraq instead of doing what they should have been doing.
That's right. And you know what? Wall Street had its version of Katrina. That was a self-made Katrina, a self-inflicted Katrina. And our government came up with $787 billion, and the Federal Reserve spent $10 trillion bailing out all the world's banks. We know that because Senator Bernie Sanders put a provision in the financial reform bill that required the Fed to reveal exactly how much money they spent bailing out the banks of the world. If we took one-tenth of that money and spend it on infrastructure and spend it on, you know, housing the homeless here, I mean, you know, providing health care for our citizens, this country, we would have a lot less problems than we do now in terms of incarceration rates, in terms of childhood poverty, in terms of, you know, fill in the blank. It's just a matter of our priorities. It's really,
priorities.
Exactly.
And the government will always prioritize their being in power and the corporations who support them and scratch each other's back way over the general people. Like, if anything is done for us, it's just, you know, a seatbelt law or, you know, some little thing for road being built. That's just kind of on the back burner. The point is they're trying to get reelected. They're trying to keep themselves in power, and they're trying to make sure, like you said, capitalism is thriving, because if it doesn't, they're not going to get reelected. And the corporations who support them and the multinationals who support them will withdraw the support and pick someone who does.
But America was not always like this. I mean, it all started really under Ronald Reagan. America, we valued the middle class. In fact, from 1947 until, I think, up until 1980, after World War II, when we were spending a lot of money, when we had a high rate of unionization, when we had a high tax rate on millionaires and billionaires, the middle class grew, and the government looked out for the middle class. I mean, we had, you know, institutions like Sallie Mae, which provided, college students a lot of money to go to school. They covered, you know, about 70% of tuition, and they helped people. And now, ever since Ronald Reagan came into office, we abide by this mantra that greed is good. We have to have government work for big business, and you know, everything is going to be surrounded around big business. And we can't have unions.
They tell us like that we need the big business. Oh my God, they that creates jobs. We need the bank. If the banks fail, we'll fail. You know, the one thing Republicans have right is like, we need less government, less government. Exactly what do we need them at all for? What do we need them at all for? All they're doing is put our money towards big business and our money towards the banks and our money towards military. That's the three big things. What all social support, everything to do with the general people, the middle class, the lower class, Everything that had, they get nothing. Everything is getting cut. Every year it's tighter and tighter and tighter. Every day, like, less there, less health care. I saw a thing with, there was on a film with Franklin Roosevelt, and he had polio, and so he had his little fireside chats once a month. But on this particular thing, he was usually on the radio, but he went live on my TV, and he said, you'll see behind a desk, he goes, I have a new constitution for America. This is what I envision for America. I go, every American has a job. There's a job available for everybody who wants to work. Everybody has education and secondary education if they want to pursue it. Everybody has a roof over their head. Everybody has a vehicle to get to transportation to their job. And everybody has health care. It's like, okay, so they have food, health care, education, a vehicle, and a roof over their head. Why that's his vision. That's 60 years ago. Why 70 years ago? Why are we now fighting just to get health care and we can't even do it?
It's all about who has the power. It's our tax rates. Our government is far more reliant on the poor and middle class when it comes to its tax revenue. There's no question about that. Millionaires and billionaires are paying a lower effective tax rate than the vast majority of Americans. Corporations are two-thirds of multinational corporations are paying no taxes whatsoever.
They don't pay, you know, GE. I just read the thing on GE. They didn't pay one penny of tax.
Yeah, and they got made $14 billion in profits, and they got a refund from the government. It's the same thing with, you know, fill in the blank as far as these corporations getting direct subsidies from the government. That's something you brought up. The corporate subsidies is killing us. Walmart, I mean, you name it. But what happens is when these people get their tax cuts that they want, when they get their tax subsidies, when they get all the mortgage deductions, I mean, you name it, they take the extra savings and they donate it to a candidate that's going to do their bidding, or they invest it in the Heritage Foundation or some anti-union organization, and they make more money. You know, buying politicians is a huge investment. You know, spend a $500,000 on a campaign donation, and that turns into, you know, a million or 2 million or $1 billion. Another way they control it is regulatory capture. We have big business now in charge of their own industries. I mean, you could look during the Bush administration. We had the Chamber of Commerce writing the Bush tax policies. We had Enron determining the Bush
energy policies. They wrote our energy laws. I mean, you brought up a great point. They write our laws. And so how are these laws going to be written? They're going to be written
And that is why, Jeff, that is why we're struggling to keep teachers' pensions, and that is why we're struggling to keep unions. I mean, the Republican Party, because of the Boeing conflict with the National Labor Relations Board, they're talking about defunding the National Labor Relations Board. I mean, this is where we're at right now. This is like Dickens England. It's like America in the 1920s. I mean, it's insane, and it's because of the balance of power. Look at the Supreme Court. Why does 70% or probably even more, why does the right wing of the Supreme Court, you know, rule in favor of big business almost any time? Because that's who has the power in our society. Working people do not have the power unless, like you say, we organize, because money will organize around us if we don't.
And so, I mean, going back to the first thing, when people say un-American and not you this, that is that. Is that what America's about? Like, because they really run this country. So if you, and when you speak out against it, you know, the government, you know, propaganda is like, oh, that's right. You're, you know, it's like back in McCarthyism when you know, the communists, you know, if you're anti-American, you're the devil, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not anti-America. It's anti-corporate. It's anti-nationalism. It's anti these multinationals who running it. It's trying to take back the country for the people who actually live in the country, the people who actually do the labor that do the work in the country, the people, you know, that want to immigrate into the country and make it a better country. It's not for those, you know, the 1% that run and control everything.
No.
And you know, every law is made against us. You know, every law is.
I'm sorry to cut you off. You know what's amazing, Jeff? I have a bumper sticker on my car that says "Beat the Rich," and I get people. I drove to California and back. I'm from New Jersey, and I had people giving me the finger for having this bumper sticker.
What did it say?
It says "Beat the Rich." Okay.
Oh, okay.
And so I have these people in Nebraska and Iowa giving me the finger, And I laugh at these people because I know they're not millionaires. I know they're not rich, but they have been duped by the Koch brothers and by the millionaires and billionaires to accept an agenda that benefits only them and nobody else. It's what the Republican Party is all about. They're all about and many in the Democratic Party. Let's be honest here. I'm not, you know, I don't support, you know, many Democrats, but you know, the reason why there's a Tea Party right now and the reason why you know, these people are so ignorant at these Tea Party rallies is because, you know, Fox News, right-wing talk radio, and the nation's most wetico billionaires, have come to the table and they said, you know what, we're gonna create a fake grassroots movement that's gonna do our bidding. They have these people, you know, wrapped around their finger. The Koch brothers say jump and the Tea Party says how high. And I always find it amazing how people will be duped into supporting an agenda that benefits millionaires and billionaires. Now, how do they do this? Like I said, they have Fox News. They have an army of right-wing talk radio hosts. They use race. They use homosexuality. Anything to get you to vote on behalf of the corporations. And it's got to stop.
Yeah, they create fear. They create, you know, just like the Nazis did in World War II, they create fear and give a common enemy, and they can make you do whatever they want. And the thing you brought up, the point that is the most kind of ironic at all, is they convince us that as we're supporting the rich, that we're actually helping ourselves. We're actually mm-hmm. making our lives better, or making America safer, or helping our own citizens, or making the world a better place for our children, when in fact, we're doing just the opposite. We're giving the control away, we're taking our voice away, and we're giving control to these corporations who are just going to continue to exploit us.
How do you feel the Cormier fight went?
It was a terrible fight. It was a terrible fight. You know, my game plan was just to box him. And if I had it over, I mean, hindsight's 20/20, no excuses. I would have fought a much different fight. That I kind of clinched him and, you know, kind of dirty box and stuff. But his stand-up was really good, and mine wasn't very good, and that was the fight. And, you know, he didn't want to take me down because he didn't want to go on the ground. And I didn't feel like I could really get him down. So, you know, I figured it was going to be a stand-up fight, and he was just better at it than me. And I had a bad strategy. And mm-hmm. Kept with a bad strategy during the fight, and he was just better than me. Than in the fight style that we did, he was much better, and you know, he deserved to win.
Cormier really seems to have got something. He's got a lot of talent. He even looks good. He moves well on his feet. His stand up, he's impressive. He's an impressive talent. How far do you see him going?
I think he could be, I mean, granted, maybe I'm a little biased, but, you know, we talked to the guys from their camp after the fight, and some of my, you know, at American Top, we got some wrestlers that are friends with, you know, like King Mo and some of the guys. And, you know, the word is that he does, you know, he gives it to Kane a lot, too. So, Kane Blacklist. So, you know, he's a tough guy. You know, his stamp was really good. He moved, he ducked, he wasn't there. He throws punches, and when I try to throw back, he wasn't there. You know, obviously, his wrestling. There's no MMA fighter with better wrestling. I mean, the guy's 2-time Olympian. So, I don't know that, you know, I think how far he goes just depends on how hard he works, you know. I mean, does he have the heart and all that kind of intangible stuff? But I think as far as athleticism and, you know, background and all that stuff, you know, he's kind of pretty high up there.
It almost seems to me as if you basically have two potential fight outcomes. Either you take someone down and you finish them, or they stop the takedown and win by decision.
Yeah, and luckily most of the time I'm able to get them down and stuff. I just have to be honest. I haven't won a lot of fights that haven't gone to the ground. You know, and this is another one. So, you know, just, you know, like I said, I would do it over, and, you know, I'm going to have to change some things. Like, we're working on right now getting better with the stand-up. I made some mistakes, getting a stand-up and dirty boxing and feeling comfortable. I get in there, I got to get him down, I got to get him down. Well, I don't have to get him down. I just got to get in a position where I'm not, you know, where I'm he's in range and I'm out of range, and we're boxing for three rounds. You know, if I get in tight, clinch, dirty box, you know, go for a takedown, whether I get it or not, you know, I'm in close. I'm going to be comfortable. I'm going to win a lot. You know, I'm going to win those advantages in that situation because, you know, I'm a wrestler. I'm in tight, and, you know, my height is actually going to be an advantage at that point. You know, standing out boxing is not. So we're just working on some things. So, you know, and obviously when we go to the ground, I'm going to feel very comfortable. And just got to keep getting better at that. You know, it's a new sport, really. You know, so it's not that old. And, you know, the strike, you see some guy that's invincible, you think, and, you know, the next time he fights, he gets beat, and everyone like, oh, well, now that guy's invincible. They beat him and stuff. And it's like nobody, you know, stays invincible for forever. So, you know, new guys come up all the time, and guys that you think were, you know, kind of peak get better, and hopefully they'll be in that category.
You seem almost impossible to finish at this stage. Can you tell us a bit about that? What makes you so durable?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I got a good chin, and, you know, I'm obviously probably not going to get submitted. So, you know, I just kind of, I try to win the fights, and, you know, unfortunately, I was on survival mode for part of the Cormier fight. It's, like I said, fighting is a lot of mental, you know, like more mental than anything else, and he beat me in every way, especially that way in that fight, and, you know, it's, yeah, obviously, I wish I had it over, but it's too late. So you got to go on the next one, and but I learned something from that and take it on. But you know, I don't think anyone should ever finish me. You know what I mean? Like just unless everybody get knocked out. I'm not impossible to knock out, but I just think it, you know, if you get some lucky hit and this happens, it happens. But just to get, you know, I don't foresee myself getting beat up in a fight where they got to stop it or something like that. So,
yeah, you never stop trying. I mean, even when things aren't going your way, which is, I think, one of the things that fans really respect about you. Have you always had that sort of drive?
Yeah, man, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. You know, I don't like to lose. And so with the good part of that is, you know, I'll try hard and, you know, like after this fight, I'm going to go back, you know, go back to drawing board, and I'm already training again. And I'm, you know, what happened to me in that fight won't happen again. You know, I'm not saying I will not, can't lose. What I'm saying is that situation, you know, I'm going to do my best not to let that happen again. And I'm going to try hard and I just hate to lose. So that's good. The bad part is when I win, I don't really enjoy it. I don't really get satisfaction out of joy. It's more of a relief. I didn't lose, and I'm already, you know, I don't enjoy it for more than a night maybe, and then I'm already thinking about my next fight, or like thinking how, you know, I won, but I didn't really fight very well, or I could have done this better, I could have done that better, and kind of like that. So there's no real, you know, I don't know. I don't know how other fighters are. So maybe some are like, yeah, I'm a fighter, yay, and I'm not like that at all. I just, you know, it's what I do, and I'm always thinking of the next fight or next competition and trying to get better, and always afraid, scared of losing, and, you know, not wanting to lose, and, you know, so there's really no, oh, yeah, my record's this, or, yeah, I won this, or it's never that way. It's always, yeah, I lost, or, I, you know, even if it was a while since I lost or whatever, and when you do lose, like this recent one, it hurts. I mean, all you want to do is get back out there and fight and erase that memory as much as you can, quick as you can.
Let's talk a bit about your background and philosophy. I think many in the world of MMA don't have the best grasp of what informs your positions on politics and so on and so forth. I think most people get confused when they hear the word philosophy and think it's some sort of thing like a self-help book or something like that. Can you describe the process of what philosophers do and what philosophical inquiry really is for some of the listeners who may not be experienced with that subject?
You know, I grew up middle class. I'd say my stepdad was more right-wing than everything, than anything. They don't really involve too much of politics. Mom was a nurse, hardworking. You know, I got a car when I was like 17. You know, you know, I saved money from college, but they helped me through college as well until I got a scholarship. And, you know, I didn't go without, You know, I was always had things, and probably, you know, high, higher middle class or somewhere in that area. And I was always go USA, and I didn't really pay attention to politics. And, you know, I, you know, respected authority and did what I was supposed to do. And, but, you know, I always had this feeling that something wasn't quite right. And I, you know, I couldn't put my finger on it. And, when I was in college, my last year, I had a substitute professor come in. He was from India, and it was a community psychology class. And we were talking about, you know, it was during the Reagan times, and we were just talking about, you know, halfway houses and this, and how it was much more, you could get more bang for your buck, you know, like grouping a lot of people together and doing like kind of group therapy instead of individual therapy and this, and how the insurance companies were against that because they wanted to make more money and this and that. Mm-hmm. And then he started talking a little bit about Reagan and where the money was being sent and how like health care and you know, mental health care and all that stuff was being you know, diminished and cut back on in the country. And so afterwards I talked to him a little bit, and he really just started the engine. Just like I thought, huh, I never thought of that. And so I started researching, I looked into some stuff, and you know, I remember going to Abu Dhabi, winning Abu Dhabi, and when I came back from Abu Dhabi, literally back to Seattle, the W2O protests were going on right at that time. And so I wasn't involved in that. I mean, I didn't know what they were about, and so, but it was right in my face, so I thought I was about. And despite what the media kind of portrayed on TV and how the anarchists were destroying the city and stuff, when the people were able to speak, and you know, the obviously sounds very liberal, they were talking about stuff. I was like, I agree with what they're saying. These small countries are just getting bulldozed over, getting no voice. These corporations, these fruit companies are going down there and, you know, taking their business, and they're not, you know, they're getting tariffed and they're not allowed to compete and all that stuff, and they're not getting anything from this. So why WTO is basically for the United States, really, and in the bigger countries. And so I kind of agreed, and then started, you know, and then when I got to travel, that was it. You know, I got to travel to Brazil and see, you know, as I'm standing in probably a 4-star hotel, a mother, like on a Wednesday or Thursday night with her, you know, 5- and 7-year-old outside sitting on a box at 2 a.m, you know, begging for a Rio. You know, I got to go to the Philippines and seeing the absolute worst plot I've ever seen. I got to go to Abu Dhabi again and actually realize that these workers who worked from, you know, the start as the sun went up till after the sun went down, making nothing. You know, that's why they make the buildings. They have these fancy buildings there, and the world's tallest building, and these, you know, oasis in the sea, and, you know, these hotels with gold faucets and all this stuff. The labor is zero. They don't pay anything for labor. There's nothing. When I was there last time, they'd actually pulled up 3 workers with their white hats or whatever like that. They move palm trees. You got to get a permit because palm trees are so expensive. And they put them there at the permit, and they found, when they moved one, they found 3 workers buried in where the palm tree was buried.
Wow.
And it was like, because they were from Syria or Lebanon or Egypt or something, and they're nothing. They're worth nothing. So they just, when they died in the heat, they weren't murdered. They just died, and they just threw them in the thing, you know, never to be heard of from again. And it's like that. Anyway, so on to the point is, I got to see around the world, like, what was really going on. And, you know, it's like, why should I have all these benefits? And, you know, it's something like, people say, oh my gosh, you don't appreciate what you have. And this, and I extremely appreciate what I have. I am extremely grateful. I have, you know, a place I'm renting. I have three wonderful children. I have a vehicle that I'm able to drive around, not the fanciest, but I have a vehicle. I have a roof over my head.
You're a need guy. You're, You're like me. You're a need guy. You don't need to have a 15 bedroom house and 10 cars. And you know what, Jeff? If you did, I'm sure if you made that type of money, if I made that type of money, I would take what I need and distribute to the rest to the people that need it more than I do, need money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd open a gym and I have a little place. I got a little three room house that I paid $7,000 for. In Nicaragua, I met, and we have a gym down there. We're making a gym and a baseball field and a little school with this gentleman up here that actually is giving a lot back to the community. He makes good money when he's giving it back. And you know,
and there's no profit on it.
No, he's making no profit on it. It's all he's losing money off. He's just doing it for that's because
exactly.
The kids down there can't if you don't have money, you got to actually pay to go to school there, even public school. If you don't have money, you don't go to school. So we're having this, you know, free school for, it's going to house 700 kids. And, you know, so I'm going to be involved in that and stuff. And that's why I'm like, oh, great, me and stuff. But that's, I don't think I could drive around in a, you know, $35,000, $50,000 car and have it. I mean, it's just a waste of resources. You know,
it's immoral. How in the world the CEOs, this is the only country on the face of this earth that allows CEOs to get $100 million. Stephen J. Helmsley, the former president of United Healthcare, made over $500 million in stock options. One guy who's the president of a healthcare company made $500 million. First of all, how is that moral? And second of all, how is anybody on earth worth $500 million? This is the only country that allows that. And it's insane. Think about
people
how you
a really good thing, something I really gotta say is, you know, you said like you right, you had that bumper sticker on, people are giving you a finger and stuff, like eat the rich or kill the rich, whatever. And it's like beat the rich. And it's like you can't get that rich without exploiting people. Unless you win the lottery. Okay? You can't get that rich unless you're win the lottery or maybe it's some Major League Baseball star or something like that, unless you're exploiting other people. That means you have a factory, you have a company, you're a CEO, and you have hundreds or more people working for you as wage slaves. You're stealing their, because they're worth more than you're paying them because they're producing products or services that are getting, that you're making profit on and only paying them a pittance of that profit. Otherwise, you wouldn't be making that profit. So you're
the
paying
average
them,
you're
CEO, stealing their labor.
Thank you again to Jeff Munson for agreeing to appear on the show. I don't think you can argue that Jeff is still understood when you have people like Brian Stan saying he should either accept America as perfect or leave it. You know, if you want to see a debate between Jeff Munson and Brian Stan on issues, I would suggest to you that this will be like a comedy show. You know, it'll be like one of these sitcoms because it would just be so funny to hear how misinformed Brian Stan is on many issues. It's just an ignorant point of view, and it's something that really, really hurts our economy and it hurts our country in general. I mean, whether you agree with Munson or not, he has a right to offer his opinion about the country just like I do. And Stan has a right to say that he should go to Mexico, but I don't know. You know, the way he categorized this country, and it just seems that Brian Stan is an intolerant person. Let's have a debate between Brian Stan and Jeff Munson, like I said. Or what about seeing him fight in a cage? That would be pretty interesting. I mean, Jeff Munson seems to be certain that he would submit Brian Stan in one round. I don't know. I think there's a good possibility that he may do that. Okay, James Toney and Ken Shamrock in a bizarre fight. Here's a news item that caught everyone off guard, but at least has them talking, which is what this was designed to do. James Toney and Ken Shamrock have agreed to face each other in some sort of MMA-type fight in Texas later this year. Details are still sketchy, but the talk is we may see some sort of a hybrid fight with different rounds of stand-up only in MMA. Sounds like one of those weird fights that we saw in K1 with Bob Sapp and other kickboxers. They usually ended up having strange or disputed outcomes.
if this fight actually takes place, I see something similar happening here, okay? There's been talk about Shamrock's motivation for fighting and what's going on with him at the moment. We'd love to have Ken on the show again. Last time Ken was here, it was a great interview. And, you know, we welcome his invitation. We'd also like to talk to James Toney, okay? I await both of your replies. We'd love to have both of you guys on. Donnie, you're like Peter Parker if he stayed home from that physics class field trip and never got super spider powers. Donnie even told me that he has an Uncle Ben like Peter Parker, although his Uncle Ben is still alive and in jail for meth. That's pretty low there, Donnie. I don't know, maybe Donnie will turn out like his uncle. Kimbo Slice is set to make his boxing debut. Backyard fighter Kimbo Slice is reportedly going to be making his boxing debut in August. No opponent has been named so far. Let me suggest one opponent, Dan Quinn. That's right, folks. Gary Shaw, put on Kimbo Slice versus Dan Quinn in a boxing match on your August card. I think Dan would be in perfect shape and a perfect opponent for Kimbo. That would be great. Dan and Kimbo have similar number of fights. They're a pretty similar size. What's not to like? What do you think, folks? Is Dan Quinn the perfect opponent for Kimbo Slice in boxing? Even if it isn't this first fight, my call for this matchup still stands, okay? CarsonsCorner@gmail.com is our address for your feedback. Am I crazy? Give it to me straight. We'll get to some listener emails on an upcoming show. I expect the majority will be in agreement with me about Dan versus Kimbo. Make it happen, Gary Shaw. We'll discuss this on other shows coming up. And our next show is going to be with Jeff Munson. That's going to be released maybe Monday or Tuesday, probably after the holidays. Part two of our interview with Jeff Munson. Thanks to Jeff Munson for appearing on the show. Him and I are friends now. We're activists, trying to reach out and trying to organize people, which is very important. I consider Jeff Munson a friend. He's a very personable guy, and what's not to like about him? Unless you're some right-wing rich person or whatever. I don't know. If you like the Jeff Munson video or Jeff Munson interview and you want to hear more talk similar to what we were talking about, you can listen to my political show. I'm going to be on a radio station in Princeton soon. This is a pretty big deal. It's a much bigger station than I was on before. And I'm also on a station here in Brick, which is a very, very small station. But you can go to bobcarson13.podomatic.com. All of my shows are archived on that website. And if you want to hear Carson's Corner streamed, you can go to undergroundprogressiveradio.webs.com. That is undergroundprogressiveradio.webs.com. We are honored to be alongside of great shows like Democracy Now! and Between the Lines. They're great shows, very, very popular, nationally syndicated shows. And Carson's Corner is along with them. How about that, huh? All right, if you want to follow me on Facebook, you can. Just type in Bob Carson. You'll see my profile come up. And lastly, if you want to follow me on Twitter, just type in twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. That's it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. Thank you very much for coming on down. I wish you and your family nothing but the best in this holiday weekend. The weather is supposed to be nice, as I understand. Enjoy it. Forget about your slave labor. Forget about your debt. Forget about Reaganomics as much as you can. And then Tuesday, it's back to the grind for all of us. So thanks a lot. Take care. And until next time, show some respect.